Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Hinwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the world of economics and politics. Two usual guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the economist James Galbraith on the fiscal cliff, just how terrified should we be of falling off. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Walter Ben Michaels, author of The Trouble with Diversity, about how the recent election was a victory for what he calls the left wing of neoliberalism. But first, a few comments on the news. I'd like to say a few words about the recent revival of Occupy Wall Street. I'm not talking about the hurricane relief effort known as Occupy Sandy, which Behind the News covered a couple of weeks ago. I'm talking about strike debt and its rolling jubilee. I want to be very careful and gentle in my criticisms, because there are some people I like and admire very much involved in it, but I do have some serious reservations. The concept behind rolling jubilee is undeniably catchy. The scheme is raising money to buy people out of debt. Here's how it works. When debt goes really bad, meaning that creditors have largely given up hope of ever being repaid, it's often sold at a steep discount to collection agents and other financial vultures, who then make every effort to collect. So, for example, if a bank throws up its hands on some credit card debt, it might sell the defaulted on paper at maybe 2 or 3 cents in the dollar. If the buyer can then collect, say, 5 cents, it's doubled its money. With that incentive, collectors often use barely legal or even illegal forms of harassment, repeated calls, threats, obscenities, whatever, to make debtors' lives miserable. The Rolling Jubilee, named after the biblical practice of Jubilee, a mass forgiveness of debt every 50 years, would buy the debt and instead of trying to collect on it, simply pronounce it dead, freeing the debtor of all obligations. So far, the Rolling Jubilee has raised almost $400,000, enough to buy about $8 million in debt at 5 cents of the dollar. Though that might sound like a lot, it's not even a drop in the bucket. So the thing is of largely symbolic importance. But what does it symbolize? That's confusing. The media coverage is focused almost entirely on the buyback, even though it have an immeasurably tiny effect on outstanding debts. And although strike debt's campaign literature speaks of a debt system holding people in slavery, debt is more a symptom than a cause. Student debt is high because college is too expensive. Mortgage debt is high because housing inflation used to be our national religion. Consumer debt is high because incomes are stagnant but prices aren't. Medical debt is high because we have an insane system of healthcare finance. Strike debt, Rolling Jubilee, say they want to focus attention on those underlying fundamentals, but I fear that no one can get past the buyback gimmick. Also, the emphasis on debt may have less popular appeal than many people think. Debt figures are driven by a small minority of heavily indebted people. For example, we hear a lot about young people with six figures of college debt, but they account for less than one-half of 1% of the population. Yes, there are a lot of people suffering from heavy debts and nasty collectors. But you could wipe all that away tomorrow, and if nothing else changed, it would start reappearing the day after tomorrow. I've written at some length in all this, so for more, check out my blog, lbo-news.com, lbo-news.com. Let's take a musical break.
Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills swirling in my bed. I know they're stolen, but I don't feel bad. I take that money, buy you things you never had. Jet plane days, get you on a higher plane to a jet stream and take you to the stratosphere and check out the planet and then take you down deep where it's hot, hot, you're ready, baby, then cool.
I was some of Patti Smith's Free Money from her debut album, Horses. I'd like some of that. My first guest is James Galbraith, widely known as Jamie. He teaches economics at the University of Texas in Austin and is the author most recently of Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis, which he discussed in this show in May. In August 2011, Congress is at a stalemate over raising the debt limit, with Republicans demanding preposterously huge spending cuts as a condition for passing the bill, which would keep the U.S. from defaulting on its debts. To resolve the conflict, Congress agreed to a set of automatic spending cuts and tax increases that will start kicking in January. The Bush tax cuts would expire, along with a temporary cut in the payroll tax, and there would be across-the-board cuts in military and certain kinds of civilian spending, though not Social Security or Medicare. If allowed to continue, that budget tightening would almost certainly throw the economy into recession, possibly a serious one. Orthodox types are using fear of the fiscal cliff to promote a long-term budget deal, which probably means some kind of tax increase, details unspecified, and cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Jamie Galbraith is more sanguine than I am about the long-term fiscal picture. I don't think the U.S. can run large deficits indefinitely, but there's absolutely no reason to do anything drastic in a hurry. Orthodox types are trying to scare us into an austerity program. Here's Jamie Galbraith to demystify it all.
We're all a flutter over the fiscal cliff. What's your evaluation? Is it something to be nervous about?
Oh, it's certainly worth being nervous about what might happen between now and the new year. This is a massive push to lock in place long-term cuts in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And if that happens, it's going to be worse than nervousness for the beneficiaries of those programs.
What if they can't come to the so-called grand bargain and the fiscal the sequester and all the bad things take effect? What would the consequences of that be?
Well, it will just go over to the early part of next year, and the next Congress will have to deal with it, which they could do within a matter of a few days or weeks. The point being is that there's no immediate calamity for the U.S. economy if nothing is done in the lame duck session, because tax rate increases could be rescinded retroactively. The spending cuts come in over time, and if they are deferred or repealed within a few days or weeks, the amount of damage is not that substantial. So the notion that this is something about which we should be panicking and that we should be forced into passing some large bill, the details of which will not be entirely clear, is false. And there are deep dangers in it, as because of the contents of that bill could do lasting damage. The whole point of the exercise, in fact, is to do lasting damage over a long period of time and to get that locked in place before the end of the year.
How do you read the president's intentions? He's sounding a little tougher in the last few days since the election than he did when he offered Boehner a grand bargain last year.
Well, the president is clearly in a much stronger position objectively for two reasons. One, he's no longer at political risk. He's been reelected by a resounding vote. And secondly, the tax law situation is very much in his favor. If nothing happens, then the whole Bush tax cuts go away, including the tax cuts on the wealthy. And so the president gets a great deal of what he's asking for simply if there's no deal at all. And, of course, again, the situation of the middle class could be dealt with by separate legislation before the end of the year, or could be dealt with immediately after the new year with very little difference between those two things. So the president is actually in an exquisitely strong position if he chooses to hold to it. And for the moment, he appears to be doing that. The important thing, though, is not is what happens when the Republicans start offering to deal, whether in the course of whether the temptation will be there to strike a bargain, which compounds what's happening on the tax front, as I say, with unnecessary and damaging cuts to social insurance programs.
Now, there's been a lot of parsing of words on both sides that remind me of a New Critic reading a John Donne poem about raising revenues versus raising rates. Does that all matter?
Oh, I think it does. First of all, it's the notion that you can raise a lot of revenue by capping deductions turns out is fallacious. It's not it's not in the same ballpark as what you can do by raising rates. But it's also not a particularly good idea. If you, for example, cap deductions on charitable contributions, you're going to be doing an enormous amount of damage, collateral damage to the nonprofit sector. And this is, this is something I don't think you want to do. I think the idea here, in fact, the right policy is to have the higher rates, but to allow people to continue to take the deductions if they make charitable contributions. You might want to cap high-end mortgages. That might be a sensible thing to do at this point. We have certainly have had enough overbuilding in that sector. I don't know actually what difference it would make to the construction, which is flat on its back anyway. But that's something to consider. But no, it's the notion that you can freely get the same result by capping deductions and that you should do so, that it would be good policy to do so. Both of those are actually wrong.
And relatedly, you hear a lot of talk about how you could close loopholes and eliminate deductions and lower rates both on the corporate and personal income taxes. Does that make any sense?
No. Next question. I mean, this is something that we've been told for a generation with absolutely zero perceptible effect on economic performance. It's simply not the case. There was a case back in 1986. There was a strong argument at that time for the combination of simplification, say elimination of deductions of various business credits and so forth, and the reduction of the top rate. And that was done. But there was no great growth boom after that. It was might have been good public policy on, let's say, allocative grounds, but it was not something that produced a long-term boom in the American economy. In fact, in 1989, we were back in a recession.
One of the tax cuts that would expire in January would be the 2% reduction in the payroll tax. What's your opinion on that?
I would phase it out over time if I had an ideal world. I don't think one wants to make that payroll tax reduction permanent or de facto permanent by simply adopting the habit of extending it indefinitely. But it might not be a good idea to let it expire all at once.
The standard line, too, is that the deficits are something that we have to worry about very much. We should lose sleep over the rising debt trajectory of the U.S., and we need to do something very rapidly to get things in order, or terrible things will happen. What's your reaction to that line?
There is just no evidence for this. And why we are talking about this is the major national problem when we're faced with still very high rates of unemployment, still an enormous foreclosure crisis, not to mention climate change and the problems that have just been made manifest to the entire eastern seaboard of the United States. We have serious problems. We should be talking about them. To be talking about a computer projection, which exists really only in the models of the Congressional Budget Office and imaginations of the economics profession, is a profoundly silly thing to be doing. It's obvious to any participant in the financial markets that this is not of the least concern to people who lend money to the U.S. government, and nor should it be. The U.S. government is always going to pay its debts, and is the U.S. Treasury bond market is a very liquid market that is a very safe place to park money, which is evident in the fact that the long-term bond rates are as low as they are.
Yeah, it's amazing that supposedly there's great worry about the fiscal future of the United States, yet people are willing to lend the government money for 10 years at less than 2% interest.
Well, it's not really a surprise under the circumstances. When the government runs a deficit, it spends more than it takes in taxes. That cash goes to the banking system. If the banking system is as basically inert as it is at the moment, what the banks want to do is to earn a little bit of extra interest, so they come back to the Treasury saying, "Would you sell us a bond?" And the Treasury is willing to do that. So the demand for Treasury bonds is not something which exists out there in the psychology of some mass of investors that nobody has ever met. It's created by the government's deficit spending, by the behavior of the banking system. And so it's, again, not a surprise that this is the case, really, but it's also the fact that it is the case completely undermines the argument that there's some cause for even concern, let alone the kind of high-pressure sales job that we're now experiencing.
I'm speaking with James Galbraith at the University of Texas.
You're very skeptical of the CBO's long-term budget projections. Why is that?
There are two basic flaws flaws in the CBO's models at this point, two that are most important in my mind. One of them is the healthcare cost assumptions, which have been criticized by a very good recent paper by two economists at the New York Federal Reserve Bank. The CBO simply straight-line projected that healthcare costs would continue to rise as a share of GDP indefinitely, which is not going to happen. We are not going to get to the end of this century spending 40 or 50% of GDP on healthcare. It's a preposterous notion, and they should not incorporate anything like that into a long-term model. It's a straightforward, clear mathematical fallacy. Secondly, they have also made an assumption about the behavior of interest rates, and that assumption entails raising the interest rate to well above the growth rate of the economy within a few years, and that's also not going to happen. The effect of doing it in the forecast is to generate this rapidly growing, compounding sum total of the U.S. debt, and therefore a rise in the debt-to-GDP ratio. But in reality, the interest rates are not going to go back to where they were, let's say, 10, 12 years ago. And the reason they're not is the Federal Reserve isn't going to put them there. And the reason the Federal Reserve won't do it is that if they did, it would tank the economy. And the Federal Reserve will tell you this. One of the governors of the Fed board said a few days ago that they're looking at the current very low short-term interest rates as far ahead as 2016. And so that being the case, the debt-to-GDP ratio is not going to be ratcheting up the way the CBO models project. Again, an error which should be corrected. When you take those two things out of the mix, you're going to see a very different picture of the fiscal trajectory, and a lot of the underpinning of all of this media talk and political talk about what kind of a problem we're getting into would simply have to go away.
Why are you skeptical on the medical projections? You know, we boomers are getting old. We're going to be a burden on the healthcare system for decades to come. Why is it unlikely?
First of all, we're not going to live forever. I regret to tell you if you aren't already aware of it. Secondly, our medical costs are not going to escalate indefinitely. Yes, of course, the medical costs will go up as the share of the elderly in the population goes up. I mean, we can either choose to provide medical care or not. But it's not going to go up indefinitely as a share of GDP. And to straight line that out to 2080, by which point I think even you or I would be a little long in the tooth, as I suppose we're both aging baby boomers, is a silly assumption. It is an assumption which something you can do on a computer, but you can't make it happen in real life.
I mean, is this just a matter of trees not growing to the sky, as they say on Wall Street?
Exactly. All diffusion functions take an S form, basically, to put it in slightly technical terms. They don't grow exponentially, and trees do not grow to the sky.
Now, what about the longer-term prospects of the U.S. economy? I think you are somewhat gloomy on those, aren't you?
I think we're facing major obstacles to any return to what we thought was normal in the post-war period, and they include very high and also unstable resource costs, which we don't control, the effect of the new technologies on job creation. These are basically labor-saving technologies, which continue to be exploited in industry after industry, and the meltdown of the financial system, which has given us a financial system that isn't doing the job that we used to expect banks to do, that is to say, making loans to ordinary businesses to foster job creation and investment. Now, those are very deep problems for which, frankly, you know, I don't have easy solutions, but I think we need to face them. And then on top of that, there is the question of climate change and facing up to the consequences and implications of that for how the economy should function. So all of these things, I think, tell us that we are in a new world. We are not in the period that existed from, let's say, 1950 to 1970 and on up into the 1990s, when we really ought to be thinking about how to adjust to that world and not, as they say, obsessing over numerical ratios that certainly the media people who talk about them don't understand at all.
Well, let's start doing a little thinking about that. I mean, how can we approach the jobs problem in a humane fashion?
Well, I think the most important first thing to do is to recognize that people take risks when they have a certain base of security. And that security has been provided for the American population by Social Security, by Medicare, by Medicaid, by a handful of other very important federal insurance programs. Cutting these back in order to provide ostensible budget savings or in order to make room for private sector activity in these areas is going to drive up the cost and reduce the viability of social insurance. It's an extremely bad idea. What we need to continue to provide to the overall population, this is basic level of care, of assurance, that we will not allow large parts of the population to fall into poverty, medical bankruptcy, in their lives. This will improve everybody's living conditions and stabilize them for the indefinite future. And that's what we need to be doing as a first task. Secondly, we do have this problem of an aging population and aging workforce. We have seen a massive reduction in the number of available jobs. And there's, I think, practically no way that one can imagine that we're going to absorb all of the workers who have been displaced in the last 5 years over the next 5 or 7 or 8 years, by which time a fair fraction of them, the older ones, will have given up looking for work and will have taken Social Security when they can get it. My feeling is that we could make this process much easier if we allowed that older cohort to take advantage of a somewhat more favorable early retirement option. Right now, you get a reduced Social Security benefit if you take it at 62, and a lot of people do. We might give that benefit to people who choose to leave at 59 and let people at 62 or 63 get the full benefit or something close to it and do that for a few years. And the point of that exercise would be to say to people who have worked hard jobs for 30 years and earned their Social Security benefits, that, yes, we recognize is a very tough time for older workers. Why not take early retirement and open those jobs up to younger workers who need them very badly? And you could make the whole transition of this particular generation much easier, the whole entry into work of the next generation much faster and easier than it's going to be.
But, of course, we're talking about just the opposite. We're talking about raising the retirement age and raising the age of Medicare eligibility.
Raising these ages is a way of imposing benefit cuts on those people who tend to be lower-income people, people who've worked hard jobs, who feel obliged to take Social Security at 62. That's what it is. So this is, I mean, I really hate the discussion of raising the retirement age. We are really not causing people, except people who have easy jobs will work longer, but people who have hard jobs will continue to take the early retirement at 62, and they will be forced to swallow a benefit cut. That's the meaning of this so-called raise the retirement age. It's exactly the wrong thing to be doing right now. Let me add another area where I think we could do some good and something that would not affect the current budget situation, and that is to raise the minimum wage. That minimum wage has been sitting down there and basically affects a very tiny fraction of the labor force. But if you raised it quite substantially, my number is $12 an hour just to fix ideas on this, you would begin to have a serious effect on the way the lower end of the labor market functions. People's wages would go up. They might lose some jobs, but the businesses that have a little problem on their labor costs would make it back on the incomes that come in from their customers. So this would be a winning situation for the American workforce and the American population as a whole. And we have a very interesting experience of this in Britain, which recently introduced a minimum wage, has raised it quite substantially, and has seen no bad effects. And it's become, in fact, a non-controversial piece of the British scene. I think the same thing would happen here. And this is a step that could be taken in the current budget environment because it actually would increase federal revenue because you'd be getting more in the payroll tax than you're getting now. So there are things that we can do, but we should be thinking about what is appropriate given the difficult situation that we face. And then one can go into the engineering issues that what would have to do to redesign, let's say, the city in which you are living in order to adjust to the obviously much higher risk of major climate-related events that we're all facing now.
Of course, your state's going to have to worry about drought in the future.
Well, that's true, and that's another tough situation, and one which is perhaps harder to mitigate because can't build a barrier against drought.
Well, finally, I think many people will listen to what you have said in the last 10 or 15 minutes and say, oh, that's all very lovely, but we just can't afford it. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the truth is we can't afford not to do these things. We can choose to make our living conditions better, make our long-term environmental conditions better, or we can choose to have an accelerated decline and to neglect the current problems. I don't see why it makes any sense to take the second course when the first is available.
I was James Galbraith, professor of economics at the University of Texas, Austin. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web worldwide to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the double variations for piano by Vivian Fine, performed by Claudia Stevens. It was written to mark the 75th birthday of the composer Elliot Carter, who died the other week. Fine is the mother of a frequent listener to this show, who turned me on to her fine music. I'm glad she did. You can hear lots of it at vivianfine.org. Vivian Fine, F-I-N-E.org. Next up is Walter Ben Michaels. Michaels' day job is as a professor of English at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He made his scholarly reputation as an author of several important books of literary criticism, but he's attracted wider fame with his 2006 book, The Trouble with Diversity, which criticized the obsession with questions of identity, race, gender, sexuality, at the expense of class. The argument does not sit well with a lot of people, in large part because I don't think they really hear what he's saying. Walter argues that the neoliberal order is perfectly comfortable with the diversity agenda, but it could never relax into a serious class agenda. Walter Ben Michaels.
Welcome, Walter. To use your language, would we describe the recent election as the victory of the left wing of neoliberalism over the right wing?
Yeah, definitely. Although I have to say it's, in the long run, probably a good thing for the right wing, too, since it's definitely been a kind of real come-to-Jesus moment for the neoliberal right. So they, you know, suddenly begin to remember that actually all the gay bashing and attacks on undocumented workers and the kind of urgency to raise the children of rapists to maturity has nothing whatsoever to do with their economic agenda. So there's a way, it's kind of a moment of clarification in which what the actual economic agenda is a little bit clearer, and the sort of para-issues, the irrelevant issues, the so-called social issues, begin to take a bit of a background.
Well, what do you make of that argument that Tom Frank made famous, that the right used those social issues to hide the economic agenda, to get the bubbas excited and get their votes, but then just govern in the interests of Fortune 500 and Wall Street once in office? I mean, was Tom's point correct?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm sure to some degree it was. I've never actually been all that committed to it. I don't think that I think people, I mean, lots of people are really committed to the social issues, and lots of the people who are committed to the social issues also happen to be relatively poor people. While it may well have been true that they were and are voting against their own interests, I don't think they were blinded by some kind of propaganda machine from above. But at the same time, it hasn't been a bad thing for the sort of, the neoliberal right to use racism as a way of masking the class issues, just as it's been a really good thing for the neoliberal left to use anti-racism also as a way of masking the class issues.
Now, it's the second part of that argument, I think, that gives a lot of people pause. So could you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, okay, an easy way to put it, or a at least a straightforward way to put it would be to say the core of neoliberalism is a kind of economic agenda which is committed to the efficiency and indeed the morality of relatively free markets. Obviously, the sort of left and right disagree on forms of state intervention, but even the hardest core neoliberals sort of get that there's some form of state intervention required. When you have a structure like that, at the core of that structure is its ethics is equality of access to those markets. So in other words, you're not going to be able to have like a kind of ethical justification for all those free markets, even one that you can at least profess to believe in, even if you in some way don't, without having the sense that people have a kind of equality of opportunity. And equality of opportunity is obviously the heart of sort of the American sense of social justice, or at least has been in our lifetimes. And there's a sense, and when you have that, the kind of the social justice program of equality of opportunity is anti-discrimination. That is, nobody should be kept from having an equal chance to compete in the sort of meritocratic free market. And anti-discrimination is like, in our era, is not only anti-racism, it's anti-sexism, it's anti-homophobia, it's anti-misogyny, it's anti all the various forms, and those are just like, you know, obvious and real ones, all of which there really are. It's anti any form of discrimination whatsoever. So it's no accident that in our period, anti-discrimination law, the rise of various kind of protected classes, has reached extraordinary heights, and that's been completely compatible and indeed more or less chronologically identical with the rise of increasing inequalities which don't depend upon discrimination. So there's a sense in which, you know, for both the right and the left, I mean, the right's discovering this too. I mean, it's no accident that within, 14 seconds of the election returns coming in, suddenly Hispanics are on the radar of the right, and suddenly gay people are on the radar of the right in a new way, and the desire not to discriminate is on the radar of the right. But they're not there giving up anything which is crucial to them to give up. I mean, what they're recognizing is that, in fact, the logic of anti-discrimination extends all the way across the board, and free markets, equality of opportunity require anti-discrimination, and it's all part of the same package. So from my standpoint, in the end, it doesn't really matter much whether you're on the left or on the right. The striking thing is just that the left convinces itself that this particular structure, this commitment to anti-discrimination, is a form of being on the actual anti-neoliberal left rather than, you know, being a way of actually legitimating the neoliberal left.
And just to make it clear, the fact that it does appear that homophobia and misogyny and racism and nativism took it on the chin in this election, those are good things, right?
Those are totally good things. I mean, our problem is that we've got this kind of populist right, which is like a catastrophe. I mean, but those aren't the neoliberal guys, right? Those are not, I mean, those are sort of like Tea Party guys who can't figure it out. And I mean, nothing I'm saying, of course, is meant to defend misogyny or homophobia or any of those things. Anti-discrimination is, in fact, a good thing. I don't think there's any question about it. It's also, however, not a left-wing thing. That is, nothing you can do with respect to anti-discrimination fundamentally affects the structures of exploitation in our current form of a capitalist economy. I mean, it may affect them in this sense that, you know, as we all know, African Americans are disproportionately unemployed in the current ongoing forever recession. And African Americans, of course, are disproportionately poor. But a world in which, you know, we actually succeeded in getting rid of discrimination would not be a world in which there were fewer poor people. It would just be a world in which, instead of African Americans just being disproportionately poor, they were proportionately poor. And white people who are under-proportionately, if that's a word, poor, they would also be poor at the right proportion. So it would have nothing whatsoever to do with the sort of fundamental structure of inequality. It just has something to do with who gets to be where in the chain of disaster. So from my standpoint, yeah, on the one hand, obviously anti-discrimination is a good thing. On the other hand, a social justice program which has at its heart anti-discrimination and which doesn't extend beyond anti-discrimination, except the occasional sort of gesture to, oh, yeah, class is also important, is one which is not, as it were, external to neoliberalism. It is the internal. It is internal to it, and it's required by it. That is to say, if you're going to have a kind of ethical justification for what you're doing, that is a sense of legitimation, what makes it fair that these people go to these schools? I mean, the standard word for it we've had for many years, right, is meritocracy. If you're going to be committed to a meritocracy, you're going to have to be committed to anti-discrimination. Anti-discrimination is the kind of operative form of justice in the society that you know, fancies itself meritocratic. And of course, we know that our society is nowhere near being meritocratic. And so we insist on further forms of anti-discrimination to try and produce that meritocracy. But of course, from the standpoint of the left, or as it were, a non-meritocratic or a non-neoliberal left, meritocracy is not what you're going for. Meritocracy is not the solution. Meritocracy is another form of the problem. So that's the sense in which I just think that there's a way in which this has been a very clarifying election, because there's a way, I think it is an important victory for left neoliberalism. I think left neoliberalism understands the principles of neoliberalism much better than right neoliberalism does. And I think a lot of right neoliberals like Romney are now getting that point.
It's funny that the word meritocracy was coined by a left-wing labor politician in Britain several decades ago as a kind of satirical critical move, but now we embraced it in a positive way.
I'll tell you, the night after the election, which I took as much pleasure in as anybody else, I mean, it's wonderful to see these people get creamed, but the night after the election, I actually got that book out and started rereading it. You know, I mean, it is, it's actually not as clever, it is very clever, it's critical. Longer, more sort of, its imitation of bureaucratic discourse is so complete and so powerful that it actually reads sometimes like somebody's bad PhD thesis. But it's a complete attack on the idea of meritocracy. And in fact, and you get someone like Chris Hayes, who supposedly on the left is a pure example of kind of left neoliberal from this standpoint. I mean, his book on meritocracy, his problem is they just don't do it right. You know, not that there's a problem with meritocracy as such, but that there's a problem with the way in which our elites have become too disconnected from others and which, you know, they don't therefore represent a true meritocracy. But the problem is not getting the thing right. The problem's with the idea in the first place.
What's the problem with meritocracy?
Well, the problem with meritocracy, I mean, here's a kind of pure, you know, version of this right now. So any kind of neoliberal meritocratic society, meritocracy is kind of utopian form, utopian ideal. There's tremendous emphasis on the importance of education. Education is the way in which everybody does get an access to the elite. But, you know, I think you published some of these, and I've looked at it a lot because it's kind of a fascinating document. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports on coming jobs, what jobs there will be 10 years from now, what jobs there are now, what kinds of educations they require. What do they require? Something like 20% of the jobs in American life today require a four-year college education. Only 20%. I may be overstating. I haven't got the numbers in front of me. So, and what are the fastest growing jobs? Like the single fastest growing job by percentage, and again, I haven't got these titles or these numbers exact, but one can check. It's roughly right. It's something like personal health care aid or personal care aid. People come take care of you when you're sick at home and when you're older. That's a fast-growing job. That job not only does not require 4 years of college, it doesn't even require 2 years of college. I don't think it actually even requires a high school degree. That's the fastest-growing by percentage job. The people who have those jobs make $19,500 a year. If everybody in the whole country went to Harvard, everybody had a Harvard education, I'm assuming just for the sake of argument that Harvard education actually counts as a good education. Everybody did that. It's still the fastest growing job in the country is personal care aides. The people who are taking aides, the people who are taking those jobs, right, are people who now have Harvard degrees, let's say in my field, you know, English or American literature. Or let's say they have them in computer science or whatever they have them in. They still, only 20% of the jobs require those educations. The other 80% don't. So these people are being meritocratically told that, yeah, by some sort of test or whatever measure we have, you, although you have this great education and all that, are not able to get one of those jobs. You get to be a personal care aide. So what, in effect, they're being told is not only do they have bad jobs and will have bad jobs the rest of their lives, low-paying jobs at the very bottom of the scale, but that what the meritocracy enables you to say is, furthermore, you deserve those jobs because you had the best opportunity. You weren't good enough. There's this other guy who got 5 points higher in the test than you did, and he can be a doctor or whatever. So from the standpoint of social justice, it's hard to see why that's a huge upgrade. I mean, what you're basically saying to, at this point, roughly 80% of your population is, you're going to get condemned to the bad jobs, but it's okay because you had a shot at the good ones. If what you're interested in actually is equality, not simply legitimating inequality, but that actually seems like the wrong way to go. And again, it's certainly not the way to go that would be implied by a kind of any kind of socialist program, or for that matter, even a social democratic one. So what the people who have personal care aid jobs need is not like a better education. They need like, you know, a union. You can't at this point farm those jobs out, right, to China, or forget China, to Burma, or Myanmar, rather, or wherever you're going to send them to. Those jobs are people right here. They're way better off unionizing and fighting for a better wage scale and fighting for the benefits they don't have than they would be saying, great, thanks, we got a chance to go to Harvard.
I'm speaking with Walter Ben Michaels of the University of Illinois in Chicago.
The education reformers, you know, Arne Duncan or Rahm Emanuel or Obama himself, they can't talk enough about getting everybody to college and you know, using all that meritocratic language. At the same time, they're creating these very militarized charter schools and busting teachers unions. Does it all make sense to you? I mean, is there actually some design behind it?
Well, that's what I mean by saying the left neoliberals are the cutting edge of the whole thing. I mean, they are sincerely committed to the meritocracy in a way that the right-wing guys have not been quite as sincerely committed. So they are at the cutting edge of sort of producing this entire structural legitimation of inequality as if it were, in fact, a technology that took you in the direction of equality. And you got a perfect version of it. I mean, you could sort of see, not as a prediction, and I claim no predictive powers at all. I had no idea who was going to win, like everybody else. If Nate Silver said so, I thought it must be true. But I remember going to a CTU, a Chicago Teachers Union rally, it must be now a couple of months ago. It was, in effect, 2 or 3 days before there was a settlement and before the strike ended. And there were lots of teachers there and lots of signs. And the sign that made the most impression, and there were a bunch of them, were ones that said, we voted for Obama, but we got Romney. And Romney was spelled R-A-H-M for our own Rahm Emanuel and Nee for Romney. And you thought, well, these are people. And these are not Tea Party people. These are not people who are, like, joining the American Communist Party, as currently led by Jody Dean, if there is one. These are people who are just teachers. They're like teachers living in Chicago. There's one down the hall from us. There's one wherever. And they totally understand one thing, that when it comes to education and the meaning of education now, that there is no difference whatsoever between the sort of Arne Duncan version of this, the Obama version of this, the Rahm Emanuel version of this, and whatever the Republican version of it would be. That is, both of these things are ways in which the core is commit to education because that gives us the promise of legitimated inequality, and bust the teachers' unions because unions give us the promise of an inequality that doesn't require this fantasy of legitimation.
To get back to the neoliberalism issue, people on the left for years have said that capitalism needs patriarchy and racism and all those other forms of discrimination and bigotry. Gary Becker, maybe 50 years ago, famously wrote that capitalism would compete those things away. That made no sense, rational sense from an economic point of view. So do you think Becker was right after all?
Becker was righter than his opponents were. I mean, Becker is the one, you know, who wrote. I mean, Becker, I guess it's Becker's dissertation, right, which must have been published originally or written back in the 60s. In which he argued that it was a big mistake to think that discrimination in hiring, he meant in particular racism, was a benefit to capitalists. He said it was a benefit to, if you discriminated against blacks, it was a benefit to white workers. And why was it a benefit to white workers? Because it enabled them to charge, in effect, a premium they got because you weren't open to employing black workers. So the whole core of the concept of taste discrimination is, in fact, that it's a problem for capital and it's a kind of partial solution for a certain number of laborers. That is to say, in this case, it's as if their whiteness functioned as a kind of de facto unionization, since to be in the shop, you had to be white. So Becker was, you know, from day one against discrimination and from day one also, of course, against unions. And there's a certain sense in which that makes sense. I mean, what we want, obviously, is a world where you're still against discrimination, but where you can be for unions. But I do think, yes, it's true that this is part of the distinction between the left and the right, again, is that, the left and the right wings of neoliberalism, is that the left wing of neoliberalism is understood much better than the right wing has, that its anti-discriminatory commitments are, in fact, not harmful to business. On the contrary, they are, you know, good for business and good for capital. And in fact, I mean, it's in a way, it's a truism. And, you know, you cannot look at any website or any brochure, any literature of any major corporation in this country without seeing its completely sincere and heartfelt commitment to diversity. That is, it wants You know, if you look at the website of Goldman Sachs is a leader in diversity. They win awards year after year after year. They're actually horrified when they were caught out as not being anywhere near as egalitarian as they ought to be with respect to their, you know, they have a class action suit against them for discrimination against women. But you want to say, that's not the deep truth of Goldman Sachs. That's perhaps the deep truth of a lot of the psychologies of their, you know, upper-level managers. But the deep truth of the logic of their business program is they don't care whether it's women, whether it's black women, white women, or what it is who are selling their derivatives. They just care that they're able to sell them. So, yeah, I think it's an important sense in which there is some truth to the idea, a lot of truth to the idea, that basically discrimination is, in its current form, you know, that is, in capitalism's current form, not only not essential, but in the U.S. and more generally in sort of so-called developed countries, countries of Western Europe, is a problem, not a solution.
What about the argument that that discrimination divides the working class against itself and creates divisions that hamper union organizing and hamper any kind of political mobilization against capital? So it needs the divisions on that level.
Well, I mean, I think it's clearly the case that certainly was true. I mean, there's nothing that divided the white working class from the black working class more powerfully than white supremacist racism. For, you know, the better part of a century. And I have no doubt that there's still some effect of that today. I've just been reading a book, which Barbara and Karen Fields' new book, Racecraft, which in effect makes a version of that argument at the end. But you turn it around today and look at it today, you could say there's a certain sense in which actually to limit the response to that racism to a form of anti-racism is equally divisive. I mean, what you want to see is that, you know, basically, I mean, it's the old 1880s populist call, black and white, unite and fight, right? Which is that the fundamental thing about you today is not your racial division. It's the fact that you do belong to the same class and that capitalism in its current form is happy to see you languish there at the bottom regardless of your skin color. I mean, that's actually one of the useful things about, you know, again, the recession. You know, the sort of dude, where's my job moment of depression in which you suddenly had all these sort of white kids, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, in college or just coming out of college. And they weren't even poor white kids. They were kind of middle-class white kids, and they had been totally led to expect all their lives that they just got pretty good grades and, you know, managed to get a letter on the football team or do whatever. They get into a decent school, and they get a good job, and they get out of it, and there is no good job waiting for them. And that's a kind of clarifying moment. It's a clarifying moment because it says, you know, actually, look, nothing is guaranteed you here. The things you thought that would guarantee you, your whiteness, your sort of middle classes, even those things don't guarantee you any rewards. And then, in fact, you're involved in a system which can absolutely afford to let you go. So I think there's a certain sense in which, you know, nothing has been more clarifying from the standpoint of, in effect, replacing a racialized consciousness with a class consciousness than the sort of the financial, you know, catastrophe of the last 4 or 5 years. Does that mean it's totally there? Obviously not. I mean, racial divisions continue. No, I mean, the idea that the Obama election that ushered us into a post-racial society was obviously ludicrous, and the idea of the Obama re-election ushers us into one is equally ludicrous. In fact, what it does is just the opposite. It creates, as I was saying before, among even Republicans who were previously just committed to, like, colorblind anti-discrimination in a kind of more or less racist way, now they suddenly want to celebrate the diversity of the Republican Party. You know, it's like if they can only find some. So someone other than Condoleezza Rice and Marco Rubio. So I think there's a certain sense then in which it certainly has historically been true that race and racism have been used to divide working class people. But I think at this point it's actually the case that anti-racism works to divide as well as racism does, and that a politics that was focused more explicitly on class and on precisely the degree to which, you know, people of very, very different colors and sexualities nonetheless share the same structural position in a capitalist economy is likely to be a hell of a lot more effective than reminding people of the values of affirmative action.
It's been very clarifying. I haven't seen much commentary on this to see the white residents of the Rockaways and Staten Island suffering the same fate that the black residents of New Orleans did after their hurricane.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you wish you'd sort of see, like, first of all, we just need Kanye West to sort of write it up. That is the Kanye West song that would deal with Obama's racism in the same way Bush's racism did would be like beyond, you know, beside the point both times. You know, it's actually just not it wasn't a matter of racism then. It's not a matter of racism now. Is it a matter of indifference to poor people? Totally. It's equal opportunity.
As Walter Ben Michaels, a professor of English at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and author of, along with several major works of literary criticism, The Trouble with Diversity. That's it for me, Doug Hinwood. Let's go out with this, You Are the Dust, from Missy Mazzoli's new opera, Songs from the Uproar, sung by Abigail Fisher with the Now Ensemble, just out from New Amsterdam Records. New Amsterdam's office in Brooklyn was hammered by Hurricane Sandy. While there are plenty of people in need of help after the storm, I've got a soft spot for New Amsterdam, so if you're so moved, please think of them. You can find more info at their website, New Amsterdam Presents, newamsterdampresents.com. Till next week, bye.